Thank you, David, and I'm delighted to be here with you in Kennaway this evening. I have never been to Kennaway before. I have a long connection with Scotland. In fact, the name Cairns comes from Scotland, so perhaps I'm back in my origins and at my roots again. And it is just a great joy to meet with you in this lovely meeting place. I hope sometime, David, you'll ask me back. I'll do my best so that you want to ask me again. Another reason why I'm very glad to be talking tonight about Japan is that there has been no assembly missionary from Scotland who has ever gone to Japan to preach the gospel. We thank God there are Scotsmen and Scotswomen there, but not from brethren assemblies. We are still waiting that day and will give them a very, very warm welcome when they come. But because there are no Scottish missionaries from assemblies connected to the work in Japan, what I'm going to try to do tonight in the time that I will share with Noel, I want to try to explain to you the background of Japan. What kind of a country is it? If I say Japan, what immediately do you think of? What kind of a country do you think it is? And particularly, what kind of a country do you feel it is with regard to mission and with regard to the gospel? Well, the first thing we could tell you is that Japan is a very great country indeed. It is not great in area. It is a group of islands off the Asian coast, but it has a population of 127 million people. And that in itself should keep us thinking. It's abreast of the rest of the world in every area of science and technology, and it's ahead indeed in a number of fields. Compared to many other countries, Japan is a clean country, a safe country to live in, and a well-organized and highly efficient society in every area of modern life. But it's, from the gospel point of view, a difficult country, and it has not been a very responsive country to the message. It is said that today one half of 1% of the population is Christian. And even that statistic is a very vague kind of statistic. There would be many people would be included in that general title. I want to try to explain to you the background to the country that has made missionary work difficult. Even though the gospel is the message that Japan needs more than anything else. The cultural and religious background can be described under three headings. And the three headings are Shinto, Buddhism, and Confucianism. Shinto means the way of the gods. Shin, God or the gods, and To, the way. Shinto is a very ancient Japanese religion. It's the traditional religion of Japan. It's an animistic religion where they worship the gods of nature and the gods of Japan, and the Shintoists claim that there are 8 million gods. Every year you will find millions of Japanese going to the Shinto shrines. I'm sure I haven't brought slides with me tonight and won't have them tomorrow either. I hope that doesn't disappoint people. But you've maybe seen photographs of the huge red gateways that are the entrance into the shrines where the gods are meant to dwell. And millions of Japanese every new year will take themselves to those shrines to ask the blessing of the gods on their homes and on their loved ones. And also when a baby is born, one of the first things they do with it when it's big enough and they feel that it's strong enough is they'll bring it to a visit to several shrines. And the family will walk around the shrines seeking the blessing of the gods on the new life that has come into this world. The worship of these gods is not really, when you talk to them, a question of reason, nor is it a question of what we mean by faith. It is more a question of tradition, a question of superstition, indeed. And because of those things, the Japanese go, but it is something else. Shinto represents Japanese identity. Japanese are Shinto, is what the people generally feel themselves to be. And there are no foreigners who are Shinto, at least so far as I know, but we have so many strange foreigners nowadays, one never can be sure. The Emperor of Japan is the high priest of Shinto. And because the high priest, he's the high priest of Shinto, for a Japanese to give up the worship of the gods, for a Japanese to give up this age-old religion, going back, they say, 2,000 years, it takes tremendous courage, because people say they are betraying their country. They are betraying their Japaneseness. They are, in a sense, betraying their families. And so, when a Christian makes a clear witness for Christ, and thank God, many of them do, even though the overall number is rather small, but many of them do, and they have to pay a price, a very big price indeed in many cases, and there is enormous emotional pressure. And so the devil blinds the minds of those who believe not. Another great religion of Japan is Buddhism. Now, Buddhism came from India through China to Japan about 1400 years ago. So Buddhism has a very old tradition and very old history in Japan as well. Buddhism is a completely different religion to Shinto. Totally different. There's hardly any way you could think about it where it isn't different. And yet, the Japanese will worship as Buddhists as well, because they feel, well, if you're Japanese, you're also a Buddhist. And so Japanese will worship as Shintoists, they will also worship as Buddhists, because these are social tradition and these are what Japanese do. Buddhism, though, gets its strength from the practice of ancestor worship. They worship their ancestors. And because it has to do with the worship of the ancestors, and usually it's a Buddhist priest who comes along to officiate at the funeral and to lead them in the worship of the ancestors, that is something that is just a part of Japanese life. Now, what I have found over and over again, talking to the Japanese, and indeed talking to Buddhist priests, they have no actual message for the people. They have no actual comfort for the people when they come to officiate at the funerals. My wife and I, for some years, used to go regularly to a hospice. And it meant that the people that we were talking to and the people that we were witnessing to, they were, for the most part, very soon going to die. Usually it was cancer of an advanced state. Now, the interesting thing is, although all the patients and most of the staff were Buddhists, yet they would welcome us when we came with the message of the gospel. They would welcome us when we came to speak to the patients, and they allowed the patients to come and listen to the Bible message. In all the years that we have spent visiting that hospice, not once did we see the sight of a single Buddhist priest. And I mentioned that to one of them one day. I've never seen a Buddhist priest come here to comfort the people. We don't want Buddhist priests near here, they said. A Buddhist priest just means death. And so, total absence of a message. But the idea of seeing a Buddhist priest coming in his robes, it would be because somebody has died. And so the message we have, praise God, is a message of life. And it's a message of hope. And it's a message of joy. And many a time we have shed tears as we have looked at the Japanese, and they'll still continue with the customs, even although they will give no hope whatsoever to the people. One day I was showing a great Christian, in fact, the man who taught me Greek in the university, David Gooding, who's been to Scotland many times too. And he was in Japan, and we got the opportunity to show him round the second biggest, the second most important Shinto shrine in all of Japan. And there was a young priest who was very helpful to us, and David would ask different questions about the shrine and about the worship, and the priest would answer and I would interpret for him. It came to the end of our little trip round the shrine, and David said to me, "Ronnie, I want you to ask him one question." "What is it?" I said. "Ask him, what would he do for me if I were dying and asked him to come to me? What would he say?" So I translated for that, and I asked the priest what he would do. Do you know what the priest's answer was? "Oh, he wouldn't come." I said, "You mean you'd refuse?" "Oh, yes, we'd refuse. But once he's died, we'll go, and we can carry out the ritual that is needed." Think of that darkness. And yet, that is Japan. And I remember David expressing astonishment at this, but the priest felt, well, isn't that normal enough? So there is Buddhism, and there is Shintoism. And speaking to them, there is a real absence of hope or real absence of any message whatsoever. The other great religion, although strictly speaking, so far as Japan is concerned, it's more a social philosophy, is Confucianism. Now, Confucianism came from China as well, and it came with Buddhism all of those centuries ago. Confucianism has to do with social order. It has to do with social hierarchy rather than religion and how we behave toward each other. Confucianism has had an enormous influence on the daily life and on the thinking of Japanese people. It is especially concerned with the relationship between the ruler and the ruled, between the master and the servant, between the husband and the wife, between parents and children. There's an awful lot about Confucianism which is good, so far as everyday life is concerned. Now, what I'm going to tell you now, I don't know if you'll consider it good or not, but when Anne, who's sitting at the back there, refers to me when she's speaking Japanese, she refers to me as Shujin. Shujin means my lord. I kind of like it, but I can't persuade her to do that when she's speaking English. But anyway, if I am referring to Anne, I will refer to her as Kanai. Kanai means the inside of the house. Now, if somebody is speaking to Anne about me, this is a bit of a difficult Japanese lesson, but if somebody is speaking to Anne about me, they will refer to me as Goshujin. And Goshujin means your honorable lord. And if they are referring to Anne when speaking to me, they will refer to her as Oksan. Oksan means your honorable inside of the house. And that is Confucianism, because there is a relationship between the different hierarchies in society. And I could tell you many stories to do with that. But the reason I'm talking about it at all is this. It has had great influence on the thinking and the relationships of Japan. And especially, what it means is that the group is far more important than the individual. So the family unit is more important than the individual in the unit. Supposing a student hears the gospel and he becomes attracted to Christ as he reads the Bible, he will be warned that he must not become a Christian, because that would be to deny his place in the family. That would be to betray the family. And the family unit is more important than the individual. And this is a problem nearly every day of Christian witness in Japan. Another big difficulty with the Japanese, and it has come mainly from the influence of Confucianism, and that is the strength of the workplace. Once a young Japanese goes into employment, the workplace takes over most of his or her life, particularly his, because it is the boys that have the toughest time from the companies. And there's no question of complaining to the company that you have to work too long. You work until your senior goes home, and he might go home. Your section chief, or whoever he is, might go home very late at night. And because it's the company and not you, your individual life, you will have to stay until that time. And whatever you go to do, the company will control so much of what happens. I remember one time a young policeman started to come to our meeting place when I worked in Kyoto. And he came for several weeks, and he was showing a great interest in the gospel, and he was showing a great interest in Christ. And we thought he was just on the verge of believing. And then one day he came along with his senior officer. No, he didn't come with him. A senior officer came to the church building. And after the church meeting was over, the service was over, he asked if he could speak to the elders. And we came and sat down to talk with him. And he said, "I've come to thank you so much for all that you have done to my constable. You've been a great help to him, and you have made him think, and I think it's been very good for him. And I just want to give you this little present as an appreciation for the police for what you have done." And he hands us the present, and he bows very low, and he goes back to the police station. Of course, you can guess the rest. We never saw the young constable again. Because even though it's done in a very polite way, the screws come on, the pressures come, and he isn't free to make that decision. So that's why Japan is a difficult country in so many ways. How then has the gospel got into this great country? How has it penetrated to any extent at all? Well, I hope it doesn't sound like a history exam, but or a history lecture, but you might find it interesting, and it might help you to pray for the Japanese. The very first time that an attempt was made, so far as we know at any rate, was in the year 1549, when a Jesuit priest, a very famous man by the name of Francis Xavier, a Portuguese and a leading Jesuit, he arrived in the South Island of Japan. Kyushu is what it's called. And it was interesting, often quoted, Xavier's comments about the country. He wrote about the Japanese people that these are the finest people I have met so far. And there are many reasons, even in those days, the 16th century, why we could say that Japan attracted him, and Japanese people and the way they lived and their cleanliness and so forth deeply impressed him. And then with his fellow priests, they got down very conscientiously to the study of Japanese. And his comment about the Japanese language is also often quoted. Xavier said, "This Japanese language is a language invented by the devil in order to keep the Japanese from hearing the gospel." And many a time, as I struggled with Japanese at the beginning, I felt a theological sympathy with what Xavier had said, because there's no doubt that it is tough at the beginning. Nevertheless, if there are young people here thinking of going to Japan, and I hope you'll think about it, it's not as difficult as people say. And while it requires, like any foreign language, it requires discipline and it requires time and it requires hard work, nevertheless, there are people who have gone to Japan with very little formal education and yet they are speaking this language so fluently. So don't worry too much about what Francis Xavier said. But they started to work and they did see amazing results at the beginning. In fact, there were many people who came, I don't know if we can say came to Christ, but they certainly accepted the gospel approach as the Jesuits saw it, and there were many, many converts. But as time went on, gradually, again, the government started to close in, and the government disliked what they were doing, even though some very eminent people had claimed to have become Christians. Many of them were persecuted. Many of them were killed for their faith. And there are stories of enormous courage of people who died and submitted to torture rather than give up their faith. And as we recall those things, we can only give thanks and bow in admiration at people who had the courage of their convictions right to the very end. But that first attempt to bring the gospel to the Japanese, it finished after about just over half a century. And because of the persecution, all Catholic people, all Christians as they were called, were put out of the country, and for the next 250 years, nobody was allowed into Japan, and nobody was allowed out of it. 250 years of national isolation, and that has left its mark upon the psychology of the Japanese people. And it has also left its mark on the relation or their impression of people from outside. The word for foreigner, non-Japanese, is gaijin. Gai means outside, jin, person, an outside person. And I'm a gaijin. I'm, no matter how long I've been in Japan or worked with them, I'm still a gaijin to the Japanese, an outside person. And that long period of isolation has left its mark on the Japanese people in every aspect of their lives. So with that persecution ended, the first attempt to bring the message of Christ to Japan. The second great attempt to bring the gospel began with an event that took place in the year 1853. In 1853, a small fleet of ships appeared outside Tokyo Harbor in Tokyo Bay. And those fleets were under the command of a very famous American. His name was Commodore Perry, Matthew Perry. And Matthew Perry sent word to the emperor. It wasn't really the emperor he was in touch with. He thought it was the emperor, but it was actually the military dictator of Japan that he was in touch with. And he suggested that Japan should open its harbor to other ships where they could take supplies and where we could begin trading with each other for our mutual good. It was a suggestion, but it was an American type of suggestion, because when the Japanese looked outside in the bay, there were all these guns pointing from the ships. And of course, 250 years of isolation meant they were the type of weaponry they had never dreamt of seeing before in their wildest dreams. And so they were forced at least to think about it. But what they did was they sent out a flotilla of small Japanese ships, and they surrounded Perry's fleet. Now, of course, they were very old type ships. And Perry sent another suggestion to the dictator. He said, I suggest that these ships disperse. Because, he said, if they don't, I'll blast them out of the water. It was a very interesting way to suggest something to people, and the ships dispersed very quickly. Nevertheless, it caused tremendous commotion. Indeed, it caused civil war within Japan as to what they should do. But in 1858, when you think about it, it's not that long ago in many ways. 1858, Japan opened to other countries. And very soon after that, the first Protestant missionaries entered the country, and Catholic missionaries did too, of course, but a work was started again. And this was the second attempt to bring the message of the gospel to the Japanese. Now, it was an amazing work that happened. In the remaining decades of the 19th and early 20th centuries, not only churches, but Christian universities, schools, and hospitals were built. But again, persecution started. And persecution gradually increased until eventually the Second World War started. And then Japan was completely under a military dictatorship. All Christians were forbidden to meet, and leading Christians, those who were leading men in their churches, including assemblies, because by that time there were about three assemblies in Tokyo and in Kobe, the leaders were put into prison and had to spend the war years in prison. And among them was were two Irish men, Bobby Wright and John Hewitt. John Hewitt later died in prison, and Bobby Wright was repatriated back home. And it was the end of Christian activity. And the military rulers completely organized the whole life of Japan. And that organization had no time whatsoever for the Christian gospel. Well, that continued until, of course, 1945. 1945, you remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki received the atom bomb. And then shortly after that, Japan had no other way out but to admit defeat. And the Allied forces entered Japan and occupied Tokyo, and the great American, another American general, General Douglas MacArthur, he became the virtual dictator of Japan for the next 7 years. Now, MacArthur was an amazing personality. MacArthur made three quick decisions, and they were astonishing decisions. The first decision he made was he sent for the emperor, "You come to me." Now, you can imagine the psychological effect on the Japanese. In their 2,000 years proud history, it was never known that a gaijin, a foreigner, would order the emperor to come to him. And there is a famous photograph of the towering MacArthur standing beside the diminutive Emperor MacArthur in his military clothes, just the ordinary clothes that he would wear in everyday work, and the emperor in morning suit. And when the Japanese saw this, it was an enormous shock to the whole psychology of the Japanese. But then his next decision happened very quickly. He said to the emperor, "Now, I suggest, you know, these American suggestions, I suggest that you get onto the radio and you announce to the Japanese people that you are not a god and you are not to be worshipped." Well, of course, the emperor went straight away, and again, that shock is still talked about among the Japanese as they heard the voice of the emperor on the crackling airwaves, and he said, "I am not a god. You're not to worship me anymore." And then he made a third decision. MacArthur sent word to churches in America and in Europe, and he asked for thousands of missionaries to come to Japan and preach the gospel. "And I personally will guarantee the freedom and safety of every one of them." What an amazing opportunity. The third time that Japan had the opportunity to to hear the gospel. And thousands of missionaries entered just after the war, including a number from England, English assemblies and Irish assemblies, went at that time, and a whole new age opened in Japan. Now, it has been, and that's what's continuing up to the present, there have been thousands of Japanese brought to Christ. There have been thousands of churches formed, and most of them, I would say, evangelical churches, not entirely, but most of the evangelical churches, and of course the work in universities and the work in schools and all the rest of it has developed mightily during this third period of opportunity in Japan. I myself went to Japan in 1960. That's a very long time ago, and that shows you what age I am. I was 22 at the time, and I traveled there by cargo ship. It took 7 weeks to get to Japan, but it's an experience that I can never forget. I worked after language study in pioneering evangelism and church planting in Yokohama and in Kyoto. I worked with Japanese and foreign believers, and in both places there are today sizable assemblies in those places, and we thank God for the great Christians who are leading the work in those places. After 5 years very hard work in Japan, I went down with a tuberculosis infection in my left lung, and I had to go back again to Northern Ireland. But after study at home, I went into academic life, and returning to Japan, I have spent over 30 years teaching in the country, and 27 of those years I've been teaching and researching in Japanese universities. As Anne and I worked among the students, and of course other people too, we saw blessing among them individually, and we saw churches formed in Izumo and Ashia. A very small contribution to the overall work, but we thank God for the overall work, and we thank God for the mighty privilege of being a part of that work and seeking to help. Again, I bring you back to what we talked about at the beginning. Outside of Christ, there is no hope for Japanese people. Indeed, there is no ultimate hope for people anywhere. And to give you a little illustration, the first job I had before I went into university, I was teaching in a language center in the big city of Osaka. And there were, every Saturday morning, in a special class that I had for advanced students, about 16 or 17 would come along for study together. We did conversation and we did English writing, and in the afternoon we did English literature. But the class was an excellent group of people. And one day we were talking, because there had been news that week in the newspapers, and we were talking about the question of suicide. And I went around each one and I said to them, "Have you ever contemplated suicide?" Every one of the whole 17 said yes. And among those 17 was a Zen Buddhist priest who came every Saturday from his temple in Kyoto to Osaka to take part in the class. After we went round the whole 17 and they all said that there had been those times when they'd committed suicide, they then said, and what about the teacher? Have you ever thought of committing suicide? Well, I said, to be honest, it has never occurred to me. I've never thought of doing that. And of course, I am very sympathetic to people in various difficult circumstances, and that occurs to them, or some actually do. But so far as I'm concerned, I have never thought, never dreamt of committing suicide. And then they said, "Why?" As though I were a strange kind of creature. And I just very simply explained to them about my relation with God, who had given me this life, and my desire was to live this life for the God who gave it, and the idea of taking it was just something that I couldn't contemplate. They expressed great interest in this. And then afterwards, two of them came to me privately and they said, "I'd like to talk to you personally about that thing you were talking about. And one of the two was a Zen Buddhist priest. And so I said, you come to my house and we'll have a meal together and we can talk about these things. So I went home to Anne and I said, Anne, 2 weeks today, we're having a visit from a Zen priest. A what? She said. A Zen priest? Why does that worry you? Well, what am I going to cook for him? Because they've got their strict rules, what they're allowed to eat and what they are. Oh, I said, I never thought of that. Men don't think of those things, you know. So the next class, which is a class before he was to come to our house, I said to him, my wife's a bit worried about what to give you. Oh, he said, outside the temple, anything. I said, what about rice and roast chicken? Perfect, perfect, he said. So I went to the station to meet Shohaku, which was his name, and one thing about Shohaku was that he was a huge fella, huge. Now, Japanese generally have a picture of a gaijin, a foreigner, as a big fella, and us Japanese, small. Well, they certainly got the thing reversed that day because the small foreigner was walking alongside this huge Japanese in his long black robe and his clogs. And you could have heard us as well as seen us because of the clogs he was wearing. And I'm sure it must have been a sight that day. And he enjoyed the roast chicken. And then for 3 hours, we sat down and talked about the realities of life and death. And I said to him in the course of the conversation, Shohaku, why do you do meditation? You've heard of the Zen meditation, Zazen they call it in Japanese, where they will sit for very long periods meditating on nothing. And that's the point. You're not allowed to think about anything in your mind. You meditate on nothing. Your mind goes empty. And I said to him, tell me, what's the purpose of Zazen? And he said to me very solemnly, the purpose of Zazen is Zazen. Oh, I see, I said. And then at the end of the conversation, before he returned to the temple, I said, Shohaku, would you tell me one thing? Have you any hope for the future? And again he thought for a moment, and then he shook his head. I have no hope. He's still, so far as I know, a Zen Buddhist priest. We can only pray that some seed was sown. But think of that, because that sums up Japan. I have no hope. Please think about that. And may the Lord lead you and guide you to pray about it. And may God move not only your heart, but your feet to his glory. Thank you so much.